I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, a pioneer in the satellite and pharmaceutical industries. She's the founder of Sirius Satellite Radio and United Therapeutics, a public pharmaceutical company initially focused on treating cardiopulmonary disorders. Martine also helped to launch the car navigation system Geostar and the satellite service provider PanAmSat, which was sold to a division of General Motors in 1995 for $3 billion. Martine lives in Vermont. She's a helicopter pilot and a parent of four children. She also used to be a man named Martin. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You are trans a lot of things. I'd like to start with your trans corporate life.
Okay.
You are a pioneer in the satellite industry, and it all started in the Seychelles, strangely, in a group of islands off of Africa. Can you describe the linkage between your discovery in the Seychelles and your career?
Sure. I really had no idea of what I wanted to do in life when I was in the Seychelles. In fact, I'd read a Newsweek article that this was supposed to be an idyllic set of islands where you could just catch fish literally with your hands and drink coconut milk. So I dropped out of UCLA and went traveling over there, feeling just really oppressed by the LA environment. So I get to the Seychelles, but it was really pretty dirty. I rented a small hut. Every night the floor would fill with gigantic cockroaches, but I was there, so I just, you know, hung out and did the best I could. One day, one of the Seychelles friends I met asked me if I wanted to go with him up to the NASA tracking station. I didn't even know there was a NASA tracking station. I went up with him, and there it was like I stepped into another reality. I went from like the past to the future. Everything was super clean and shiny and high-tech looking with blinking lights. And a very nice NASA engineer gave us a tour and explained what they were doing. And I asked him, why is this antenna that you have so humongous? Because it was bigger than a house. And he said, it's because the signals that we're tracking from deep space probes are so faint, they don't even have enough energy to light a light bulb. So we have to have a humongous collecting area in our giant satellite dish to receive the signal. And I asked him back, well, what if the satellite signals were very, very strong and powerful? He said, well, it's not possible to launch those type of satellites today, but if it was, then our receiving station could be very small and tiny. And the idea dawned in my head that if I could figure out a way to launch a powerful satellite, then everybody in the world could have their own tiny satellite receiving dish. Mm-hmm. I made a beeline back to UCLA. It's like I received a kind of quasi-religious epiphany in the Seychelles that I was going to connect the world with satellite communications, and this was a technologically practical thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I went from having a C average at UCLA to straight A's because I had a passion that I was going to be the world's expert on satellite communications.
You were in your late 20s.
Correct.
Were there other examples in your life of, you know, having the moxie to say, you know what, I'm going to transform something? What were examples of that in your childhood?
My transformative examples were from biographies and also from science fiction. I was fascinated with the Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov series of books. And those examples of people who transcended their background to become, you know, the man who purchased the moon and people who went to Mars, those books inspired me.
Your mother always thought there was something unique about you, but I just thought, well, you know, welcome to being a Jewish mother. Did you ever have a sense of self that kind of extended beyond what you thought other peers experienced?
No, I didn't. I really felt myself pretty much a totally average person and lazy and usually trying to figure out the way to get something done with the least amount of work.
And how about your parents?
My parents were hardworking and great people, but my dad was a dentist for the Retail Clerks Union, so he had kind of like a 9-to-6 job. My mother was a speech pathologist at San Diego State College, so she would go there and teach each day.
What, in your mind, was the most pioneering or innovative experience you had in the satellite realm?
One of the, to me, the most remarkable stories is when I was running Sirius, one of the business plans was to get the major radio stations to major radio networks to invest in Sirius and to put their content on our satellite network. So I went to see Mel Karmazin, who was at that time the CEO of Infinity Radio Network, which hosted the Howard Stern Show nationwide. And I went to Mel and I did my satellite radio pitch and I said, this is going to be the future. Everyone is going to listen to satellite radio. And he laughed at me and he pivoted on his desk to his credenza and he said, you see these piles of paper here? He said, these are audience research reports that I commissioned to find out what the audience listening to each of our radio station thinks, what their demographics are, what their age is, how many of them are. He said, now, how high are those piles going to be the day you launch your Sirius XM radio system? I said, well, on the first day, there'll be nobody listening to it. He said, exactly. He said, Martin, get a real job. So the funny coded...
Fast forward a few years later, and who becomes the CEO of Sirius?
Mel Karmazin, yeah. And I loved having a chance to recount the story to him when I was on the Howard Stern Show. He remembered it. But it just goes to show... What he was saying was not incorrect, but my vision for Sirius was pay radio. And the whole paradigm of regular radio was commercial advertiser-supported radio. So it's an entire paradigm shift that had to be promoted.
What else surprised you about launching a service like Sirius? Was it the regulatory hurdles or?
I expected there to be regulatory hurdles. That process always involves taking the radio frequencies away from somebody else. So there's always an adversarial process involved. But what has surprised me with Sirius, to this day, I would say more people come up to me and thank me for providing Howard Stern and other content to them via Sirius. Then people come up to me and thank me for saving their children with the medicines that we produce at United Therapeutics.
What does that say?
I think it says that information is very, very important. In fact, there's a quotation I've heard that says, information is the necessary, if not sufficient, basis for development.
You left Sirius and you found yourself in another industry, the pharmaceutical industry. And I purposely used the passive because it didn't seem like an active decision to go into the pharmaceutical industry just on the face of it. You have a daughter, Genesis, whom you discovered has a disease, a pulmonary hypertension disease. And she's the one who came up with the idea that you launched this company. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's true that my first love and actually most lasting love is space technology, satellite communications. If I could snap my fingers and sort of like, you know, reimagine the whole universe, I would be right back running either Sirius XM or probably even like a Elon Musk SpaceX type of company. But the fact of the matter is that I love my children, and my youngest daughter, who is just a beautiful, simple child, gets diagnosed with this life-threatening disease, pulmonary hypertension. There were no medicines available, so it wasn't a matter of thinking about it. I just went to the library and began doing research.
Now, you mentioned you went to the library, but it was you and she who would go to the library
we
together.
Would. That's true.
7-year-old Genesis.
Yes, we would together. She was very, very helpful, and I would say to her, I know there was an article by Dr. Rich, and she would say, wait a second, and this is Stuart Rich, a physician in Illinois, and she'd look through the pile of Xerox copies of articles and say, here's the Dr. Rich article.
You launched United Therapeutics with your own capital.
That's correct.
From Sirius. The drug, which later got FDA approval, was developed by a gentleman, James Crow.
Correct. There was a gentleman, Dr. Crow, at GlaxoSmithKline, who had a solution for pulmonary hypertension, a new medicine, but Glaxo would not let him develop it because the patient population was too small. And GlaxoSmithKline had recently purchased the Burroughs Wellcome Company. Burroughs Wellcome was a very old line pharmaceutical company, and they would develop things whether they were profitable or not. So SmithKline, Glaxo, bought them. And when they bought them, the first thing they said is, we are not pursuing any more of these you know, fairy tale dreams. We have a filter. We will only pursue drugs that promise $1 billion or more in revenues, which are called blockbusters.
You got hold of Dr. Crow's telephone number?
Yes.
And called him?
Yes, cold called him.
And what was his posture towards you originally?
Great skepticism. How is somebody who is a satellite CEO going to develop a medicine? How are you going to get it out of a pharmaceutical company? I'm very sorry about your daughter, but there's nothing I can do to help you.
Miss Martine Rothblatt, upon hearing that, that probably just put more fire under your belly.
It did. I was actually, he did me a great favor by doing that because I was pretty much back to the Martine who was galvanized by the dream of uniting the world with satellite communications. And I said, now, you know what? I did something like that. I can do this. Yeah. I can do this. And coincidentally, at the very same time frame, people sent me two movies to watch. One was Lorenzo's Oil. There was a story of a father trying to save his son by doing things that pharmaceutical companies wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And another was the archetypical entrepreneur movie called Tucker, about this man who invented the seatbelt, the parabolic headlight lens for cars, the shatterproof glass for windows, who after World War II tried to create a new type of automobile called the Tucker and was beaten down by the big three automakers in Michigan.
United Therapeutics is public. You became the highest paid female CEO in America. Upon FDA approval, the stock price went up exponentially. And how do you navigate that? What does that mean exactly?
So what it really means is that my compensation is tied to our stock price.
So this was as of 2013. And you're not somebody who really revels in the public light. What were your reactions when media was coming to you because of this fact that happened almost accidentally?
So it's basically a kind of embarrassment, at least in my own personality. I don't try to be the center of attention. But I do realize as a public company CEO, every element of my compensation is publicly disclosed.
And by the way, when I first read that fact and the fact that you were previously a man, I thought, seriously, the highest paid female CEO, of course, has to have had been a man.
I feel that that's unfair, too. I agree with you. I tell you the truth, I had exactly the same feeling. But I do know in other years, the highest paid female CEO had always been a female. So I'm sort of like the exception that proves the rule.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt. We'll hear more from Martine coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, a pioneer in the satellite and pharmaceutical industries. She's the founder of Sirius Satellite Radio and United Therapeutics, a public pharmaceutical company initially focused on treating cardiopulmonary disorders. Martine lives in Vermont. She's a helicopter pilot and a parent of four children. She also used to be a man named Martin. United Therapeutics is public, and your annual reports, I think they're kind of
different.
Unconventional. You tell me about them.
So our annual reports are different. One of our annual reports was in the form of a graphic novel that told the story of a new employee. Another of the annual reports was in the form of a children's book. It was patterned after Goodnight Moon. It was called Good Year UTHR, that being our ticker symbol. Another of the annual reports is in the form of what we call a periodic tablecloth of utelements. So we make an annual report because that's something that's legally required, but there's no rule that says your annual report can't be a children's book.
The company now is extending beyond just hypertension, and I'm intrigued by your focus on xenotransplantation, which is basically taking animal organs and surgically putting them into human beings.
Correct. Although the real trick there is to first genetically modify the animal organ so that it will not be rejected when it's put into the human being. And we formed a joint partnership with Craig Venter's company, the man who decoded the human genome, called Synthetic Genomics is the name of his company.
Why focus on a pig versus another animal?
So it's an odd quirk of nature that of all the animals in the animal kingdom, the animal whose organs match the size and shape of humans better than any others is the pig, even better than chimpanzees, by the way.
Now, this is somebody who grew up in an observant Jewish household. Were there any even irrational just reactions that you might have had when you first discovered this?
You know, the good thing about all religions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, is they really are very rational within their own belief system. So Judaism, like Islam, like Christianity and Hindu, believe that the sanctity of life rises above all other things. By the way, I did my PhD thesis on xenotransplantation. I interviewed rabbis, imams, people from all the different religions, and it turned out that all of them said, we accept the transplantation of animal organs, pig organs in particular, mm-hmm. into bodies. So it's kosher. It's halal. It's okay if it's being done to save a human's life.
You have a pig farm in Vermont. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Right. So the name of the pig farm, it's called Revivicor. What's grown there are pigs that already have several genes knocked out. We now be having modified the first few genes of the pig. Our organs, when they're placed into a person, last from months to as long as over a year now at the NIH. In fact, my mantra to the company is inspired by JFK's mantra when he said, I want to land a man on the moon and safely return them to the Earth before the end of the decade. I tell people in our company that we want to transplant a xenolung into a patient and return that patient safely to health before the end of this decade.
You're a helicopter pilot. Is there any connection between wanting to get your helicopter license and this endeavor?
As most people know, when organs are donated for transplantation, they're generally transported by helicopter because you only want to have the organ outside of a bodily system, outside of blood and whatnot, for a short period of hours. So to avoid traffic jams and to go over long distances, organs are usually transported by helicopter or plane from location to location. I'm also a fixed-wing pilot as well. It would give me a great sense of completion of accomplishment to be able to personally deliver one of our first sets of xenolungs to a waiting patient.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, the founder of the pharmaceutical company United Therapeutics. Martine is transgender. She became a woman in 1994 at age 40 after having had sex reassignment surgery. I want to talk about your transgender life. How has this physical change changed the way you feel?
That's a really tough question to answer, especially, you know, briefly. I think the answer that really bubbles to my mind is, as being core and essential, is that I've always felt like a woman. So I found myself, as I went into my teenage years, identifying with the women in the room where I would be instead of the men in the room. Yet I was totally, obviously aware that everybody considered me a boy and then a man. And I was totally aware that when somebody deviated from those socially accepted roles, that they were sanctioned, they were laughed at. I didn't want to be laughed at. So I kept my feelings of being a woman tightly bottled up inside myself because I didn't really want to be laughed at.
I would think a man who understands women would be very attractive to women. Did you have girlfriends? And
I did. I mean, when you're talking about like sexual orientation side of being a woman, my sexual orientation has always been to women as a woman. So if I was to give it a label, it would be a lesbian label. Yet I was faced with this contradiction that I had the body of a man.
What's an example of, you know, you're identifying with the women in the room?
I'd say, like, if there is a topic being faced in the room and one group of people are kind of hard-edged about solving the problem and the other group of people are maybe like, maybe there's a way we can massage the situation, I just naturally go to the massage the situation.
In 1995, you wrote a manifesto called The Apartheid of Sex, which demystified or criticized the classification of things by gender.
That's correct. And My point of view was that was really based on the research that came before me, specifically Professor Ann Fausto-Sterling from Brown, who had written that there are not two sexes. There are actually multiple different sexes. She discovered, for example, that it's not as simple as saying women have two X chromosomes and men have an X and a Y, because there are people born with two X's and one Y, two Y's and one X, all kind of variants in between. But in most cases, these intersexualities were not so manifest that they were observed by surgeons at the time of birth. So nobody said, oh, this is an intersex child.
So these are genetic mutations.
Yeah. I would say it's part of the natural diversity of human life. And so that got me thinking, well, if there's all of this fluidity in the body, there must be just as much fluidity in the mind.
You said that separating people by gender is similar to separating blacks and whites, which, of course.
And by the way, when I wrote that, it was considered like crazy. Mm-hmm. But now in Germany and a couple of other municipalities, parents can decide not to stamp male or female on a child's birth certificate. Mm-hmm. And the idea of being gender queer, basically self-defining one's own gender, has gone from being, you know, totally on the margins to, I would say, for people who are like millennial generation, it's beginning to be like, you know, a thread of that culture.
Speaking of race, your wife is African-American, Bina Aspin. You married her in 1981 when you were a man, and it was a surprise to her 10 years later that you wanted to undergo this sexual reorientation. Mm-hmm. How long were you thinking about this before you actually mentioned it to her?
Well, I would think about it the whole time because I've been transgendered feeling since I was a teenager. So I thought about it the whole time, but it was something that I thought just had to be bottled up forever. And fortunately, there were pioneers who came before me in the 1970s and 1980s, people like the ophthalmologist Renee Richards, who also became a tennis star. And I read other biographies of transgendered people who had come out. And there's a judge in Houston, Texas, Judge Phyllis Fry. So these people gave me hope and inspiration that maybe I could come out as well.
And her response?
Her response was immediately open. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, my God. There was never an oh, my God. It was, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really interesting. That's fine with me. I love you for your soul, not any part of your skin.
And she calls you Martine. She's Martine sexual.
And I feel my identity is being a sexual.
Your children, talk to me about your approach to them. And I'm curious as to the array of responses.
Sure. Well, all four of them were very accepting. And I'm eternally grateful to them for that, because so many other transgendered people I know have horrible situations of being disowned by portions of their family. And so I said to each of the four kids that this is what I wanted to do, change my sex to female, but I would not do it if they objected. And each of them had a very different response, perhaps reflecting their various ages. The oldest was my son, Eli. He was about 20, okay? And he said, it's your life, Martine. You have to do what you want to do with your life. He was a student at Johns Hopkins at the time. The next oldest was Sunny. She's a fashion designer here in New York City now. She was at that time about 18. And she said, lots of my friends have two moms or two dads. I don't see anything so strange about that. So it's really interesting that she saw it in a totally different way, as just like now she has two moms.
That's right.
Whereas I've actually never really tried to be the mom. They still call me dad, but that's how she saw it. My son, Gabriel, who was in junior high at the time.
Hardest, probably.
Yep, it was the hardest. And he said that friends would tease him. And he said he only wanted to know would I still be his dad. And I promised him, Gabriel, I'll always be your dad, no matter what. And he said, okay, it's okay with me.
I read in New York Magazine that you said, well, I'm going to be like a butterfly.
Yes, I did say that. He has four children now, and they call me Grand Martine. And then the youngest, yes. Genesis, she was quite young. She was 10 years old. And she was actually the one who outed me to my own parents. because she told them, you know, Martine has these women's clothes that she and mom wear when they go out places. And then my dad and mom asked me, is this true? Why would you do this? But Genesis said, well, it seems to me just I love my dad and she loves me.
Hmm.
And it was just remarkable how she just switched the pronoun and made the whole thing make sense.
That's right.
So she said, okay.
And your mother?
My mom said, look, we could have had two daughters or a son and a daughter. It doesn't make any difference to us.
I've noticed sometimes in this interview I'm confusing pronouns and things like that. Does that get under your skin?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. I'm like totally flexible with it. In fact, it's kind of an interesting recherche test to me. Just going out with strangers. Some people say ma'am, some people say sir. It's almost like 50-50. And it's kind of really interesting. But I'm like, as long as, you know, you call me Martine, I'm happy.
See, you have the mind of a woman. Like, you're so understanding.
Thank you. Thank you.
Was marrying an African-American woman almost equally striking to people at the time?
It was shocking to some people. Mm-hmm. This was less than 20 years after it was illegal for people to marry people of different races. The Supreme Court case Loving versus Virginia was decided in the 1960s. So it was, our kids were teased. Our oldest son, Eli, said kids at school would call him a zebra. So I think it was analogous.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, the highest paid transgendered CEO in America. Martine is also transhuman, launching efforts to extend human life and achieve immortality through biotech and artificial intelligence. Her most recent book, called Virtually Human, The Promise and Peril of Digital Immortality, is written with Ray Kurzweil, the lead engineer at Google. Could you describe briefly the thesis of your book?
Sure. A lot of the top engineers in Silicon Valley have been working on creating cyber consciousness, allowing things like Siri to develop greater and greater capabilities until they're really personality operating systems. So what always intrigued me about that, perhaps because of my legal background and I have the PhD in medical ethics, what are the ethical consequences of creating consciousness in software? Do we have the right to create consciousness and consciousness and then just turn it off?
Now, your hope is to, if I'm speaking correctly, you know, being transhuman is to bring immortality and life extension to people both in the body, but also out of body through things like mind clones.
Well, that's right. I believe that the purpose of the biotechnology industry in general is to keep people alive longer. So Ray Kurzweil was, I think, the first person to ask, well, when does that end? You know, if you ask yourself that question, you realize that there is no ending point, that as long as somebody values their life, we all would like to keep that person alive as long as possible.
So what will happen to your body when it dies?
When my body dies, it will like, you know, well, in the case of me in particular, mm-hmm. it will be frozen at a company called Alcor in Arizona, what's called cryonization.
And how about your digital self?
My digital self will, I believe, be, after a span of some years, be activated as a mind clone of my flesh brain and will continue a life in cyberspace.
Now, when you say a mind clone of your flesh brain and be in cyberspace, I think you lost listeners there.
Sure.
A little bit. What is a mind clone?
A mind clone is if you take all of your digital reflections of yourself, which you've uploaded to the cloud and to servers in your computers, all of your Facebook postings, all of your likes, all of your blogs, all of your photos, all of your Instagrams, if you take all of that, and then you wrap you purchase some software called Mindware that elicits the personality evident in those uploads, and you combine the two, you end up with a mind clone of yourself, a software version of your mind that has most of your memories, feelings, recollections, and beliefs, and also has your characteristic expressions, mannerisms, and how you think.
Now, who wants to be around Martine's mind clone? Do you think your wife, your kids? Who else beyond that?
No offense. Yeah, no problem. I think my friends would also want to be around my mind clone. And where, I would will, also want to be around their mind clone.
Where would you live? Where would the mind clone live?
The mind clone would live in the cloud and presents itself wherever there's a display.
And by the way, I'd be curious about my mind clone because, you know, I don't know myself enough to know what that mind clone would be. Are you kind of curious about what the outer manifestation of yourself is beyond what I see in front of me?
I think there'll be lots of books written about with titles such as 10 Things I Learned About Myself from My Mind Clone.
You live in Vermont, and you have started this organization called TerraSim, which mm-hmm. is devoted to life extension. And I think of Vermont as being bucolic, and here you have this, you know, uber futuristic endeavor. And it reminds me of your experience at the Seychelles, which I have not been there. Also, in my mind, seems like a, you know, placid bed of islands. Yet NASA was tracking satellite systems behind a closed door.
Correct.
Do you think about that dichotomy in both places?
I do. I think that Vermont is very bucolic and beautiful. On the other hand, Vermont is also a place where there are a lot of great scientists and information technology. IBM has a major center there. University of Vermont has one of the nation's most advanced gene sequencing machines. So there's a lot more technology going on in Vermont than people would expect.
What is something that I might not know about you? We're talking about how you're trans a lot of things.
One thing you might not know about me is that I have not purchased a ticket on a rocket ship ride around the Earth, and I have no interest in doing so. My feeling is that the Earth is the greatest spaceship in the universe. We can see almost all the different stars, certainly in our own galaxy. As we travel around the sun, we get a different perspective of the entire sky. In the meanwhile, we're perfectly comfortable. We can breathe the air. We can jump and swim and fly in the air. So I treasure above everything else Spaceship Earth.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Martine Rothblatt. Coming up, we'll meet Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper, a company focused on sleep. Casper's leading product is its mattress, which can be ordered online and delivered in a box to your door, sometimes within hours if you live in New York City. The company keeps it simple by making a one-type-fits-all mattress for consumers and believes that more choice does not mean more comfort. Casper was launched in April 2014 and had $1 million in sales in its first month. Philip is a graduate of University of Texas. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the number of years one spends sleeping. So if you're, let's say, you have a lifespan of, let's say, 80 years, that's like 25, 26 years, right? Like,
It's about a third of your life. So it's an incredible amount of time. And that was something that we took very seriously when thinking about designing our mattress, was that it's one of the products that you interact with the most.
Now, you had a lot of experience with mattresses. Even before you founded Casper, you had sold about 40,000 beds. While you were a sophomore at University of Texas, you had started a company called the Merrick Group. Can you describe how you came to sell 40,000 beds? Is that right?
Over a decade that I ran that company. Mm-hmm. And really kind of fell into that category very accidentally. So with the Merrick Group, I was basically looking to avoid getting a summer job when I was in college and had the idea to build websites for products that a manufacturer would then drop ship to customers. And we sold products like window blinds, futons, tickets for sporting events, poker software, and randomly met some mattress manufacturers and sold some mattresses. And that's how I learned about this category. There's two parent companies today that own the four biggest manufacturers in this category. they work very closely with retailers to make sure that consumers don't have transparency about what they're buying. And that allows them to keep pricing high, and it allows them to keep margins high. And that forces you into a store where you're greeted by a commission salesperson who's highly trained at getting you to spend a lot more money than you have to.
So we all have had that experience of going into, let's say, Sleepy's or Bloomingdale's and, you know, laying on the mattress for 8 seconds and be like, yes, this feels right. Like, you know, it's so hard to really tell the difference between one and the next. It drives you crazy.
The reality is, and what we have said since the beginning, was that the only way to know if a bed is right for you is to sleep on it. And oftentimes it means sleeping on it for many nights so that your body can readjust to proper anatomical support. And that's why our mattresses come with a 100-night trial. And if at any point you don't love the mattress, just call us up and we'll come pick it up.
When it came time to start Casper in 2014, what led you to decide to jump into the mattress or the sleep category? I know you had had that former experience, but I mean, you could have picked anything.
So honestly, it was one of my co-founders, Luke, asking, why is there no Warby Parker for mattresses?
So it was one of your other co-founders that coincidentally mentioned mattresses without his even knowing that you had this experience in mattresses.
Yes. And when they quickly learned about my background, they just thought that was an amazing coincidence. And it led us to talking about kind of people's sleep habits and just a conversation that we kept coming back to. And we were in the same, four of the five of us were in the same co-working space. And so we were literally sitting next to each other.
So you all met kind of accidentally.
Completely serendipitously.
Where was that co-working space?
It's in New York. It was on the west side.
One of your co-founders is Neil Parikh. And
yes,
coincidentally, too, his dad happens to be a sleep doctor.
Yes. There were a lot of amazing coincidences that came together.
Did you work out of that space together because it had brought you together?
No, we did not. We were working out of hotel lobbies. We were kind of bouncing around coffee shops. Eventually ended up in a different co-working space down in Soho. At that time, it was just us and an idea, and you know, we had no money, and it was just trying to put together the pieces that we thought we'd need to launch Casper.
And why the name Casper?
So the inspiration of Casper was actually Luke's roommate at the time. We thought it was kind of funny because Luke's roommate is like a 6'6 British guy who did not fit on his twin mattress at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of all got a chuckle out of that, and we dismissed it at first. And when we got back together the next day to think more about names, and we had what felt like a million names on the list, it was the one that we just kept coming back to.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper, the online mattress company. Casper is focused on providing a better night's sleep for its consumers, starting with its mattresses, but extending to other products such as its pillow and sheets as well. Casper also publishes Van Winkle's, a website focused on all things sleep. I want to talk about the simplicity. Like when you just said in, among the five of you, that you were just going to make one mattress, that's it. Were you initially skeptical, or were you all kind of, yes, of course?
Honestly, we didn't go into the whole business saying we only need one mattress. It was more of, let's see what we could build and let's see if people liked it. And it turns out when you combine the materials the way we combined it, everyone loved it. It didn't matter if you said you wanted a firm mattress or a soft mattress or a medium mattress. People loved it. And so as a result of all of this consumer testing, we said, why build another one?
How did people find out about the mattress initially? I mean, I did not see any marketing in the early days. Was it all word of mouth?
So we raised, our seed round was $1.85 million, and we raised that before we launched. We launched the bed on April 22nd of 2014, and we were fortunate to have a few people write about us and report on what we were doing, that we had raised some money and that we had built this mattress, and we had just taken a very different approach to an industry that hasn't seen innovation in a long time. Much to our disbelief, people woke up, they read these articles, and they started buying beds. And we didn't think that was going to happen. And then the second surprise was that the people that bought the bed, the people that got the bed, started talking about it on social media. They were taking pictures of it. And one of the most surprising things were how many people were filming the unboxing of the mattress. And that's something that's really unique about our experience, is that the mattress comes to life in a box that's about the size of a mini fridge.
Where were those initial articles?
It were things like TechCrunch. It was very kind of startup focused outlets. And I think Namely, they covered us because we had some funding from some great investors, and no one had really heard about kind of a mattress startup taking venture capital money.
Was this your first time taking venture capital?
It was, yes.
And what was that experience like for you?
Ben Lear of Lear Hippo Ventures led our seed round. They're one of the top seed firms in the country.
How did you meet him?
We met him. We were actually introduced to him through our branding agency. This was actually after we had been told no by dozens and dozens of investors. And so, you know, we at this point, we were feeling a little dejected, and we had complete confidence that we were going to do this no matter what, even if we didn't raise a penny. And then, of course, you know, we meet Ben after we're told no so many times, and Ben just immediately got it.
Why do you think you got so many no's?
So I think there were a couple of things. One is that traditional angel and venture investors in this space always think about things in lifetime value. And how could you possibly have lifetime value if you're just selling them a mattress? And what I would come back with that is saying that the mattress industry is huge. Over $14 billion a year is spent by consumers in the U.S. at retail on mattresses. So, you know, that's a big pie we could get our small piece of. And it just didn't resonate with them because it's not how you traditionally look at e-commerce businesses. That and then at this time, again, we weren't live. And so we didn't have our brand fully baked. We didn't have our experience fully baked. So when someone comes and tells you, oh, I'm going to build a really cool mattress brand that's going to be totally different than anything out there, you know, it's hard to wrap your mind around that. And so I get it. It does take a leap of faith, certainly, to kind of see what we see and
And then come Series B round, you raise $55 million, and included in that, in addition to the Pritzker family and institutional venture partners, are celebrity investors like Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire and Adam Levine of Maroon 5, the band. How did these guys come in?
You know, it's funny when you tell people just how terrible the mattress buying experience is, whether you're a professional investor, an institutional investor, or just a celebrity or angel investor. Everyone kind of gets the opportunity that there's a space that's big and really important to people, sleep and sleep products, and it's really broken today. So with them, it was just, you know, introductions from other investors or from other friends, and it's great to have them on board because they get how it takes to build a brand, whether that's your personal brand or a company brand.
In addition to having this products company, you also publish or fund a media website called Van Winkles, which is focused on everything sleep related. Why is it called Van Winkles, by the way?
Van Winkles goes back to the early days when we were trying to come up with a name for the business. I was championing Van Winkles. I thought it was a great name, and it's named after Rip Van Winkle because he fell asleep for 40 years. And I ended up getting outvoted, and we ended up all liking Casper more. So Casper became the name, but Van Winkles just always stuck with me and with the founders. And so when it came time to launch an editorial venture, we thought it was the perfect homage to the beginning days of Casper.
What was your thinking surrounding that? Just that one would fuel the other, kind of?
Honestly, the idea was that we thought sleep was such an interesting subject, and yet no one was owning or kind of furthering the conversation around sleep. Sleep is so universal. Everyone needs a night of sleep, and yet everyone has such a personal connection to it. You know, we even talk about at Casper how there were big health movements that changed the way people thought about healthy living and well-balanced living, and whether it's exercise, which happened, you know, decades ago, or healthy eating. We think sleep is kind of the next big pillar on that. 10 years ago, people were bragging about how little sleep they got, and, oh, you were an investment banker who was getting crushed at work, and you stayed all and pulled an all-nighter, or a student. Now you don't hear that anymore.
I want to talk about operations in the early days. You had trouble with fulfillment in the early days because demand kind of outstripped the supply of the mattresses. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely.
I mean, what a hard problem to have, but go ahead.
it was really painful. You know, at its peak, I think customers were waiting 6 to 8 weeks for mattresses, and that was something that drove us crazy because we knew these customers, you know, were giving us good faith to try the product, and then to be so delayed was really painful. So the first day when we realized we were going to be out of stock, and we realized people were not going to have a bed when we promised them, Neil thought of, let's just send them an airbed that we could buy on Amazon and ship directly to consumers, or to our customers. And so we were scrambling, pulling out our credit cards, buying airbeds for customers, shipping that, saying, you know, we really apologize. Here's a gift to you so that you have something to sleep on. And it took us many months to build up the proper amount of supply capacity. And mm-hmm. it was a huge struggle in the business. But fortunately, it's behind us. And now we're in inventory positions and ship on time within 24 hours.
Whose idea was the bike?
Honestly, we didn't even know that the box would fit in the beginning. And so we were just looking for courier partners on literally the launch day to deliver some of these beds. And so the couriers pulled up on this cargo bike, and we were just like, let's see if this fits. And it fit perfectly. It's actually become, I think, one of the more iconic images of the brand in the early days was this cargo bike with the mattress on it. And I think the bike had matching colors randomly. And it's been awesome.
You have a showroom in NoHo on Bond Street, and people can kind of just come in and try the bed out if they want to. You also have one in LA and some pop-up stores. When you thought about the business initially, was it strictly kind of an e-commerce company?
The day we launched, we had customers randomly coming by the office, knocking on the door and saying, I'd like to try the mattress. And so we quickly set up the back third of our office as a bedroom. And so anytime someone would come in, we'd happily greet them and offer them iced coffee or water and let them try the bed. And it stuck. There's no ground floor presence, so you would only find out about it if you looked on our website or our mobile site. But every day we have tons of people coming by and laying on the bed now.
I want to talk about your personal life. You grew up in Texas, in Houston. What did your parents do?
So my dad's always been an entrepreneur. He's originally a New Yorker, but he had ran his own fishing boats out of Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn in New York. And in the late 70s, when the oil business in Texas was picking up, and specifically offshore oil in the Gulf, he had taken the fishing boats and converted them to offshore supply and crew boats that serviced rigs in the Gulf. And so that's when he moved down to Texas and he met my mom. And again, that was late 70s, early 80s. And so he did that for most of my childhood.
You mentioned that you avoided conventional jobs. What were one or two that you had, if any?
When I was in high school, I would have a summer job at one of the local country clubs, working there.
Doing what?
Running the food cart around the course. That was one, or just, you know, at the clubhouse. Kind of just a variety of jobs. One summer before college, I worked at a software company that was developing technology so that companies could monitor chats within the company for compliance issues. So lesson learned is don't talk about coworkers on chats at a company where they monitor your chats was something that
you don't do at Casper.
Don't do. Yeah.
And how about your mom?
My mom, she's currently working in Houston, but growing up, she was a stay-at-home mom.
And do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister who's a nurse.
You know the term sleep tight?
Yes.
Do you know where it comes from?
I could guess, but I'm not certain, no.
People used to sleep on, or do sleep on, like ropes, right, on them for their mattress. And if you pull the rope tight, it ensures a good night's sleep.
That's interesting. I will have to read more about that one. That would not have been my guess.
What was harder for you than you thought in the early days? Because, you know, you had such great traction and acceptance from consumers. And yes, you had the hiccup with inventory, but what has been harder for you than you thought?
So one thing is hiring is definitely harder than I thought. And no one told me as a founder how much time you would just have to spend with hiring. And certainly when you're a young company, you know, no one knows how it's going to go. And, you know, again, people perceived us as this mattress company. So how could what you're doing be interesting? So hiring was certainly a struggle where we spent a lot of time. Another thing that was maybe not harder than I thought, but something that was just interesting was this founder dynamic. And so three of my co-founders had known each other for a long time. They went to school together at Brown University. And so, you know, Jeff and I were the new guys of part of the team. And in looking back, it was so important. And we just had become very good friends. And I think it's just because we spent so much time kind of thinking about the business and even outside of that, just having fun as friends. And so it's something I probably took for granted that you need to do and invest in. And it's just worked out great, though.
Well, you're lucky that you were able to navigate that with, you know, five founders and not two founders.
Tremendously lucky. I mean, five co-founders is very rare.
What might I not know about you?
That's a good question. Recently married.
What is your wife's name?
My wife's name's Kimberly.
And what does she do?
She just got her master's from Columbia in public health.
How did you meet her?
I met her actually on the roof of my building in the city. So one of my friends went to Syracuse University with her as an undergrad, and he was visiting us from LA, and we were both friends with him, and so he decided to combine friends so that he could see everyone while he was here, and we just hit it off there.
When did you meet her?
So it was before Casper. She saw kind of when I got excited about the idea of Casper, and tells the story fondly of me kind of waking up in the middle of the night saying, like, you know, this could be something really exciting, and then saw the five of us get together and go for it.
You know, you'd say in the middle of the night, you'd turn over and, you know, what were some of those conversations? What are some details maybe about that you might remember?
You're asking that question made me think about it. On Van Winkle's, we talk about all the time how looking at blue light is bad for your sleep. And when you look, that's why you're not supposed to look at your phone when you wake up in the middle of the night, because it's then harder to fall back to sleep. And inevitably, I always still look at my phone and then the light comes on. And then if she sees the light, she'll say, what are you thinking about? And so that will spur random conversations at times. And to this day, I still look at my phone, even though I know that's bad for sleep and not proper sleep etiquette.
In fact, you guys should take the phone out of your room.
We should, yes. And, you know, it's funny. There was tons of, like, prescriptive sleep content out there. You should take your phone out of the room. You shouldn't look at your computer before bed. And just things that, like, I'm a big sleep advocate, and yet I would never do those things because it's just not going to be conducive to my lifestyle.
So how many hours of sleep did you get last night?
So unfortunately, I had a dinner work event, and so I didn't get home till later than I would have liked. So I probably got 6.5-7 hours. It's not bad, but I'm someone who needs a lot of sleep since I was a little baby. Mm-hmm. And as my wife will say, gets cranky when he doesn't get enough sleep.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.